Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, Senior Clinician in Rabbit and Exotic Animal Medicine and Surgery at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, Jenna Richardson. Thank you, Jenna. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, thank you very much. So thanks for joining me today. We're going to have a chat about cystitis in guinea pigs, something that can be quite a frustrating condition. And so the overview of the webinar, we're just going to have a very brief recap on what are the most common health complaints that we're seeing in our guinea pig species. How important and how we can get the most from our health checks when we're seeing these patients into the clinics. What clinical signs we would associate with cystitis and urinary issues, and what diagnostic tests we can perform, what treatment options there are, and ultimately, what's the prognosis that we're going to be discussing with the client and preparing them for their pets. So just to have a little think about guinea pigs, they're rodents, and specifically hystricomorph rodents. They originate from South America, and they are true herbivores. So in the wild, they will consume fairly large quantities of grass, and therefore high fiber is extremely important in their diet. As well as a high fibre, guinea pigs are quite unique in that they have an absolute dietary requirement for vitamin C. They are not able to synthesise vitamin C on their own, and therefore require supplementation either in their water supply, via vitamin C added to their pellets, or via vegetables and fruit that they are fed within their diet. As well as requiring high fibre diets for their dentition, they have constantly growing cheek teeth as well as constantly growing incisors. So we see problems of dental disease very commonly in this species. But they also need high fibre diets being hindgut fermenters. So they have a very large cecum, and it's therefore super important that they are having both digestible and indigestible fibre, so lots of hay required in their diet, similar to rabbits. They're also a very social species, so we don't recommend a guinea pig being kept on its own. We also don't recommend them being kept with rabbits, as bullying can occur, and we can also have transmission of Bordetella. When they're in groups, I mean, they're quite comical little chaps, and very vocal. Certainly when it's food time, they'll let you know about it. And owners will often report changes in how vocal the guinea pig is, depending on health status as well. So common conditions, and I think it's important to know that common things are common. And therefore, whenever I see a guinea pig in, I always have these at the back of my mind. Now, obviously, there's lots and lots of conditions that guinea pigs can get, but dental disease is one of the most common. We also see a lot of ectoparasite problems, so mites and lice, and that can be quite debilitating for them. They can be quite pruritic with that. It can also be an indication if there's a large ectoparasite burden that actually we've got some underlying disease process going on, and being immune compromised with reduced grooming capabilities. And so it might be that actually, as a secondary effect of, say, cystitis, for example, we may actually have a lice infestation because we're run down and not doing as well. So ectoparasites can be a crucial indicator that something is brewing and further investigation is needed. Cystic ovarian disease, obviously a female condition, but again, that's something we see very commonly, particularly in middle-aged guinea pigs, and incidences of up to 76% is reported in this particular species. Now, the focus today for us is on cystitis, and I've kind of put over on the right-hand side here urolithiasis and cystitis together. And that's because the two we're going to discuss today, but often they occur concurrently. And it's a little bit chicken and egg situation as to which one has occurred first. One can lead to the other, and certainly one can result from the other. So when we're thinking of investigation, it's important that we are looking for both of these things, and not just assuming that we have, for example, a bacterial cystitis. So if we consider our health check, that really is the opportunity to detect either the things that we see commonly. So with these photos, you can see we've got a lump along the dorsum of a guinea pig, and that's a trichofolliculoma, which is one of the most common benign skin growths that we get in this species. Something as big as that, surgical removal would be advised, and often these things can be missed by the owners, and the health checks is the opportunity for that to be identified and then an appropriate treatment provided. The bottom picture, we can see we've got overgrown nails, a little bit of curvature of the lateral one, sorry, the medial one, and a little bit of pododermatitis as well. So the health check time is the time to pick up the things perhaps owners hadn't been aware of. And the very first thing I do for my health checks is I look and assess the demeanour of the animal. Now, some guinea pigs are very used to being handled, they're very relaxed, and they'll sit up on the consult room table, always pop a towel down so it's not slippy for them. And they may be munching away on their hay, or if the owner's brought some veg treats for them. And they seem quite relaxed, and you can assess their breathing rate, their effort, whereas others might be quite timid and therefore prefer to maybe hide underneath the towel, and give them a little bit of reassurance that way, or maybe keep them in the box with the buddy while you're doing the auscultation part of your clinical exam. So I always start off with my TPR. I start with my heart rate. Respiratory rate is often falsely elevated due to the stress of travelling to the vet, and also obviously being prodded and poked, and so they can be quite stressed out by that. But nonetheless, you can see whether or not we've got increased abdominal effort, and any increased noise associated as well. Now, for the temperature part, and this is something that I think a lot of people mistaken. It's a little bit tricky in guinea pigs, because their anus opening is quite well hidden. So I thought it was a good point to just go through, taking the temperature and also making sure everyone's comfortable with how to sex guinea pigs as well. Now, in the males, particularly when they're entire, it's really quite obvious because you can see from this bottom picture that we've got rather large testicles here. And they sit in the kind of para-anal area. They don't have a scrotal sac per se. And again, in a mature boar, it's very easy to extrude the penis. But what we're looking at in the males is a very round preputial orifice. And because the testicles can go intra-abdominal in young males, it can be tricky to palpate those. But certainly, we're looking at a round opening there. And also remembering that males have an os penis as well. Now, in older boars, just as an interesting aside, this region here can often get quite dilated, and we can get fecal impaction in there. Now, when we're looking to take the temperature, a big mistake that people will make is just to put the thermometer basically where my arrow is, so just below the preputial orifice, and that goes into a kind of blind-ending pouch, and so we can get abnormally low temperatures. So what we're wanting to do is come down at the level of where the star is, so we almost sort of come down, and there's just a little opening at the very bottom, and that's where we're going in for taking temperature. So important when we're assessing our patients that we can get, these accurate parameters and readings. For the females, the anogenital area is Y-shaped, and you can see on this bottom picture, we've not got that round area. And it is important to remember that there are three openings in the females, and particularly if we're thinking on this webinar on cystitis, we want to know if blood is coming from the opening for the urethra, or whether it's coming from the vulva. And obviously, if it's coming from the vulva, that would be suggestive that perhaps we've got a reproductive issue. And certainly, knowing how common cystic ovaries are, we can see secondary endometrial hyperplasia affecting the uterus. And in some cases, that can transform and become a neoplasm. And leiomyoma, for example, is something that we can see affecting the uterus. And we could then have blood coming from the anogenital area, which could be falsely diagnosed as a cystitis. So, if we're thinking of the anatomy of the female, just remembering that we have the urethral opening right sort of at the sort of between the slits of the Y, and then at the bottom of the V of the Y, that's where the vulva opening is, and then right down at the bottom of the Y, that's where we have the anus. So again, just important that we're familiar with our anatomy going forward to really appreciate the clinical exam findings. So once we've considered the demeanour of the patient and we've done our auscultations, also very important to look at the weight because again, being prey species, they're very good at hiding signs of disease. So it might be that you're looking for trends of reduction of body weight, and that can be then detected from the previous clinical record. And if we've got a significant weight loss, say 100 grams, you know, in the last 2 months, then obviously that's something that needs to be identified. We would also correlate that with body condition score as well. And then we move on to our nose to normally tail, but as we don't really have a tail on these little guys, so nose to bottom examination. And this is the one where, you know, while you're going through and systematically palpating and feeling all the different structures, you know, working your way through in a nice systematic approach, all those common diseases that you know that these guys can get should be going through your mind. So when you're palpating the face, you're checking for lateral jaw motion, you're looking at incisor length. We'll get to full dental exam in a little minute, but you're palpating just like you would in rabbits around the lateral and the medial and the ventral areas of the jaw, looking for any swellings, any discomfort. You know, they're very good guinea pigs at telling you if you're annoying them or hurting them. So if you press on a spur of the dentition, then they're going to let you know about that. Again, when you're looking at the feet and palpating individual toes all the way up the legs, you're checking for pododermatitis of the foot pads, the nail length and curvature. And I think it's very important in guinea pigs. I kind of call them the divas of the rodent world. They're very good at making a lot of fuss and a lot of noise, and sometimes that can be overinterpreted. So when we're palpating the abdomen, for example, it's often quite good to go about it in a systematic approach. And if they're making a lot of noise and giving little screams and squeals and so forth when you're palpating the stomach, but they do the same when you palpate the cecum, and then they do the same when you palpate the bladder, we can presume this is just a guinea pig that, you know, is a bit annoyed that you're having a general palpate of them. Whereas if they're pretty silent and maybe just making little chirrups as you're palpating, and then you reach that caudal ventral abdomen area where the bladder is, and you have a gentle little palpate and they're screaming or bobbing their head and showing you that it's uncomfortable, then I'll normally go around and palpate my different structures of the abdomen again and see if that same discomfort is repeatable. And if it is, then I usually class that as significant, and I would say that we need to investigate further. The other thing that's very common in our particularly geriatric guinea pigs is stifle arthritis, and that can certainly affect how our guinea pigs posture and pass urine. So having a gentle palpate on both stifles, checking for symmetry. But as it's often bilateral, don't be confused by knobblinis on both sides and thinking that's normal. We've said ectoparasites can be a sort of secondary issue and an underlying cause, resulting in sort of immune suppression or reduced grooming. And then mammary masses, you know, don't forget we can get both benign and malignant processes going on in those mammary glands of both species in the inguinal area. So when we're doing our ventrum exam, we're making sure that we're visualizing the nipples, palpating thoroughly on the mammary glands, and also looking at the anogenital area for any discharge, any scalding or staining as well. And then we can think about the dental exam. I know this is a cystitis talk, so we'll not dwell too much on it, except to say that no physical examination of a guinea pig is complete unless you have looked in the mouth with an otoscope. Now, when you look in the mouth of a rabbit, it's lovely and clear. You can see quite easily the cheek teeth. You don't push the otoscope in too far because their diastema is not that long and we don't want to hit against the first premolar. But nonetheless, you can normally get very good visibility. When you look in a guinea pig mouth, it's like looking in a swamp. So you'll have some of last night's dinner, some of this morning's breakfast, and maybe a little snack they had en route to the vet as well. And it's a good old mess. So what you have to do is take your time, wet some cotton tips, and just gently clean the mouth out. Some people flush just with a syringe of water. I always worry I might cause them to choke a little bit with that, so I just go for the cotton buds. Usually about 8 double-sided cotton buds sweeping out, and that gives me enough movement to remove a lot of that green and brown sort of material and get a good look at the teeth. Now, the act of cleaning with the cotton tips is useful in itself because you can have a sort of sneaky sniff of the cotton buds, and obviously if we've got halitosis, then we might have infection and you're going to detect that. But also this picture here shows a prepared lower mandible. And we know that entrapment of the tongue, so the tongue would sit in this area here. And what we've got is elongation of the lower first premolar. And you can see these are almost touching. Now, as you're cleaning out the mouth with a cotton bud and running it down rostrally, the cotton tip will stick against this and it won't come very nicely at all. And so what we can tell just by creating some space to look in the mouth is already we know is there infection present from the smell, and are the teeth impeding the movement of the cotton tip. So then we look in the mouth and we can hopefully confirm our suspicions with good visibility. So normally that is where a clinical exam would end, with demeanour, auscultations, weight, nose to bottom exam, looking at the ventrum, and then obviously the dental exam, maybe look in the ears as well. If for most species, guinea pigs, we don't need to do that with an otoscope. But what I do now do, particularly for my geriatric guinea pigs, is I will add urinalysis in as part of a thorough physical examination as well. And that is quite an important one because we are seeing so many cases of either asymptomatic or subclinical, I should say, cystitis, or maybe cases where actually they're in a group situation, and so it can be difficult for the owner to identify, where the discoloured urine is coming from. Is it relevant? Is it porphyrin? And by performing urinalysis as part of the clinical exam, it can help rule in or rule out potential problems. So how do we collect the urine? Well, the easiest way is manual expression. Free catch is something that certainly can be used, but there are a few problems with it. So of course, the posture of the guinea pig is pretty low slung to the ground, which means once they urinate, then it can sort of get mixed in, particularly with some fecal material, maybe stood on, absorbed into the fur a little bit. And so we end up getting quite a contaminated free catch sample. Manual expression, so certainly not foolproof. We're still likely to get some contamination. But what I do when I'm taking that is I'll give the anogenital area a little wipe, a little clean with some dilute Hibi scrub. Then I hold the guinea pig like you can see in the picture here. So their back is against my front, one hand around the thorax, the other hand supporting the weight of bottom, but using the thumb to gently press that caudal abdomen area, and allow for expression into usually a cat litter tray that's positioned below for catching and sample. If you were worried and say that you'd seen frank clots of blood coming and you think that there's going to be infection there, then obviously cystocentesis is the best way of getting a uncontaminated sample. And I always do that under ultrasound guidance just because we've got such a large cecum that lies ventrally, taking up most of that lower abdomen area. And what I wouldn't want to do is to accidentally pop a needle into that as opposed to my bladder. So whenever I'm doing performing cystocentesis, I will always do it under ultrasound guidance. So the other problem that we can have as well, I should have said, with a free catch sample is our guinea pigs are not like rabbits or cats. They're not litter trained, and they're not like dogs that would lift their leg or squat to allow us to get the sample. So, having area free where we can get a good free catch sample can be quite tricky. So manual expression is my preferred route. And then once we've got the urine sample, what are we going to do with it? Well, there's a few things that should always be included. So the first one is a dipstick analysis, so nice and straightforward. Ironically, there's not a lot of published information on all the normal values we would expect on guinea pig urine. So I often take from rabbits and kind of extrapolate a little bit. But the ones that are published are stated here. So we would expect glucose to be negative. We don't tend to see it so readily elevated as we would in, say, a mouse or a rat with stress. So when we have elevations in glucose, it can be related to diabetes mellitus, which is something we see in this species. And if that is the case, then obviously we need to check for ketones, but we'd also perform a blood glucose check to see if we've got an elevation in that value. Red blood cells on dipstick we would expect to be negative. Guinea pigs always have alkaline urine, so the pH is always between sort of 8 and 9. We wouldn't expect to see any white blood cells, and if we have them, then that's a sign of infection. Urine-specific gravity, so as we would for any other species, dipstick is not a reliable way of ascertaining our USG. Ketones should be negative, and the colour can be really very varied, and we'll get to that in a minute. But you can see on this picture here with the syringe, this has been allowed to settle for an afternoon, and we can have quite a lot of sediment, and this is too much. This isn't a normal amount within guinea pig urine, but we can see quite a chalky sort of look to the urine of a guinea pig. Now, I went to BSAVA a couple of years ago now, and in the abstract sections, there was a rather lovely presentation looking at the visual appearance of urine samples from pet guinea pigs, bit of a random one. But what it did show was the absolute huge colour range of the urine. And it was laid out, there's a rather great picture which I couldn't find in my I did take a sort of photo of it at the time. But it looked like a paint colour chart and going from a sort of fairly deep purple all the way up to a pale sort of yellow straw colour and everything in between. And what this study sort of showed was that the appearance can really greatly vary depending on how much crystalluria we have, what kind of feeding regimes have been adopted, and how much porphyrin is being passed at the time. And so even within the same collection of guinea pigs, the range of the turgidity and the colour within the 72-hour period that the study was performed was really quite vast. And so what we can take from that, and what we know already is that we cannot diagnose a urinary tract infection just based on the appearance of the urine alone. So even if we've got deep red urine, It could just be related to porphyrin or a change in feeding regime. And we do therefore need to follow it up with microscopy, which we then need to be thinking about always doing sediment analysis. So when I think about your analysis, I do my dipstick, I do my sediment analysis, and I do my urine specific gravity. And those three sort of go hand in hand together as part of my basic urine analysis. So for sediment analysis, well, guinea pig urine usually contains fairly light coloured sediment in a fairly low amount. And as you would expect, if you have a low USG, then that's more dilute urine, so it's likely to be clearer with less sediment. And if we have really cloudy urine, then most commonly that results from calciuria. But the reason that we need to perform microscopy is because cloudy urine can also be associated with the presence of white blood cells, epithelial cells, bacteria, mucus, and potentially red blood cells as well. And in general, seeing the occasional red blood cell on a sediment might not be too alarming, but if we're seeing larger amounts, then definitely that's likely to be significant. Crystalluria, so although it is common, we see calcium carbonate as the most common, which is the same as in rabbits. And you can see this picture here where we've got the kind of dumbbell structure, and then we've got a circular structure with kind of striating out lines from the centre. They're both different forms of calcium carbonate that we can look and find on sediment analysis. Bacteria, so depending on where your samples come from, if it's a free catch sample, then obviously we're likely to see a lot of bacteria within, and potentially, particularly if we've got fecal contamination. If it's a manual expression and there's a lot of bacteria, then if we've cleaned the anogenital area, then that is going to be significant that there's a lot of bacteria. And obviously, if we've got any phagocytosis with bacteria included in the white blood cells, then that tells us that we've got an active infection going on, as does the presence of the white blood cells. As with other species, if we've got casts, then that can be a sign of renal tubular disease. So sediment analysis is a really important part of our investigation for urinary issues. Urine-specific gravity, so we use a refractometer with that. As I said, we don't rely on our dipstick. And the range is pretty huge. Quite different trends that can be seen. But again, ongoing monitoring, if we've got persistently low USG, then that might be that we're not concentrating our urine as efficiently. Another one I did want to measure, to mention rather, is our UPC, so our urine protein creatinine ratio. And this is something that we use a lot here at the clinic in rabbits. So we say that a UPC of less than 0.4 is considered within normal range. But it's not been found to be as effective and useful in guinea pigs. So as a result, I tend not to use it in guinea pigs as a species. There was again another abstract at BSAVA proceedings that looked at normal values of urine protein creatinine ratio in some pet guinea pigs and found that it doesn't really seem to correlate very well. And in fact, the range of values was very huge. And so I would always put a little bit of caution about going ahead with UPCs and sort of just taking the results perhaps with a little pinch of salt, maybe use them for comparisons against themselves. But I don't think we can say that they are reliable in this species. What else can you do with the urine? Well, if we're suspecting that we've seen bacteria present on the sediment analysis, then obviously we will want to perform culture and sensitivity, allowing us to make the best antibiotic choice. And again, if you are taking a sample, then the ideal is you're performing that by cystocentesis or by catheterization, but by catheterization, you could potentially introduce bacteria that way. So cystocentesis is my sort of preferred for obtaining a sample for culture. And if you're working in a dog and cat bias practice, then just check in with the lab that you're sending the sample to as to what kind of panel of antibiotics you're going to have used. Because if you're getting amoxicillin, for example, then that's not a helpful drug to be using in guinea pigs. So just making sure the lab is familiar with the drugs available and can be used for this particular species. So thinking about cystitis, what are the general clinical signs that we can see with this? Well, confusingly, at times, they can be asymptomatic. So as I said, as part of my sort of thorough clinical exam and health check, I do check the urine of geriatric guinea pigs, and very often we find that there's white blood cells present and bacteria and red blood cells. And these are in guinea pigs that have been doing okay. There has not been a perceived problem with them. But that said, in many cases, clinical signs are shown. And they are ones that you would expect. They're ones that we're familiar with for other species, so hematuria, stranduria. As a very vocal species, they can be very good at telling the owner when it's uncomfortable and straining to try and pass urine. It might be that they're normally popcorning all over the place, which is the little jumps that guinea pigs do, and they're normally shouting when they hear the fridge go door going for the veggies, but actually they've become subdued and they're not so interested in their food. So we can see changes to the demeanour. If the bladder is sore, or if we've got an ascending infection to the kidneys and the kidneys are painful, then when we're handled and pressure goes on the abdomen, then we can be very vocal, very resistant of handling when previously we've been fine. If we're voiding urine little and often, then we can see urine staining or scalding. And certainly, if we're inactive and sitting just where we're passing urine and feces, then we may find that there's discoloration to the fur coat and the start of odour at the rear end. Signs of pain, so we can have a hunched posture, we can see teeth grinding. And whenever we have pain and stress in our little herbivore species, then we can have GI stasis as well. Now, just one slide to mention about GI stasis, because we're probably more familiar with it of in our lagomorphs, so in our rabbits. And there are so many causes for GI stasis, so pain, anaesthetic, surgery, underlying disease. Poor husbandry with inadequate diet and etc. And we see it as reduced fecal droppings or small droppings. We can have anorexia, weight loss, lethargy, and ultimately this is a serious condition. So maybe we've got a primary cystitis, maybe there's a secondary ectoparasite issue, but top of the list now becomes the GI stasis for management. And we have to get on top of that. So fluids, analgesia, warming therapies, gut stimulants, supportive nutritional feeding as well. So all of these things are very important. So getting back on track to our cystitis, what are the causes? What can cause this? So we can see it with bacterial infection. We can see it secondary to urolithiasis. And potentially we can have it with poor diet, and this can be more of a secondary thing, either from immune suppression because we're not getting enough vitamin C in the diet, we've not got enough or an appropriate quantity of hay, and we're being fed too much high calcium diet. So, inappropriate diet can certainly be a precursor and a predisposing factor to urinary issues, as can secondary effects of inadequate water intake. And then I've just sort of mentioned genetic stress, idiopathic, because there are some theories that perhaps there's a genetic predisposition to development of cystitis, but there's just not quite enough information on it to really provide some useful conclusions. Stress, this is more anecdotal, but certainly in the clinic, we can find that if a guinea pig comes in, has previously been well, maybe it's in for a lump removal, and then in the recovery phase it develops a cystitis. So, understandably, we could then look at a link between the stress and maybe immune compromise and development of these conditions. So things to keep stress levels down are important. And sometimes we don't know why it's happened, but we then have to deal with them. So for bacterial infection, well, we do seem to find that females are more prone to ascending bacterial infections, and that's kind of logical because their urethral opening is closer to the anus than we see in males, and the urethra is shorter in the females as well. And we do know that bacterial cystitis is often seen concurrently with urolithiasis. Now, what we don't know is which one comes first. Does the presence of the bacteria act as a nidus for infection, or does the irritation and inflammation from the presence of urolith then lead to bacterial overgrowth? So probably both is the answer, and certainly concurrent problems are seen. Now, there's quite a variety of bacteria that's found causing bacterial cystitis in guinea pigs. E. coli tends to get pegged as the most common, but we can see strep and staph species, Corynebacterium and Chlamydophila as well. And depending on which literature you look at, there is quite a lot reported in lab species from the 70s and 80s, and therefore may not be certainly applicable to individual pet species today. But the importance of culture and sensitivity is always key when identifying what bacteria are affecting and causing the signs of disease. So what we know about cystitis from all other species is it's uncomfortable, it's painful. So when we're thinking about how we treat it, we've got to consider analgesia. And buprenorphine is a good opioid to consider. It's got a longevity of action, so 6 to 8 hours, more useful than butorphanol, coming in at much less. Dose rate, I tend to go at 0.03 mg per kg, but there are a lot of exotic animal formularies with dose ranges in, so you can extrapolate and use what what you've had experience with, but that's certainly my preferred. Meloxicam is something to consider, but as you would expect, you've got to consider your precautions. Are you concerned over your renal function? Is your patient hydrated? And if you're concerned that there could be concurrent kidney disease or we've got dehydration, then you need to rehydrate your patient and maybe investigate the renal parameters with serum biochemistry, get some hematology, make sure we're not anemic secondary to renal disease. Obviously, our full urinalysis. And then we consider as well our diagnostic imaging, which we'll cover in a few slides time, but that is to look for concurrent urolithiasis. When we're thinking about blood sampling, so there are a few good areas that we can get blood from in the guinea pig. Something I've started to do a lot of now is lateral saphenous. And that is done conscious in the right kind of guinea pig. So you just have them with their back end in lateral recumbency. So their little legs are sort of parallel to the table, and their front end, they're in sternal. And using Emla cream, you make sure you clip a good area of fur away, and I'm usually going right in at the back aspect of the leg. Just above the region of the sort of level of the stifle, but on the back of the leg, halfway between the stifle and hip area. And you can usually get 0.5 mL of blood from that before it goes too slow and maybe thinks about clotting. You can also, if you have your patient anaesthetised, go for the femoral or the jugular or the cranial vena cava. And in some of the guinea pigs, particularly the older ones that have quite large ears, then sometimes the little veins on the ear vessels with an insulin needle could be used as well. So obviously for bacterial infections, the whole sort of treatment revolves around appropriate antibiotic choice. And we are in the era where we have to be responsible with the antibiotics that we're using. We shouldn't automatically reach for a fluoroquinolone as our first line antibiotic. And we should always be encouraging owners to perform culture and sensitivity, particularly because a lot of these cystitis cases are frustrating and they can wax and wane, and we can see flare-ups and repeat flare-ups. And so knowing what bacteria you're dealing with, knowing if you've already got multi drug resistant bacteria, is very important as part of your management strategy. And it's important to have that chat with the owner fairly early on. While you're waiting, however, for your culture results, you do want to start some antibiotics. And my first line is TMPS, so trimethoprim sulfate. I usually go at 1:5, 15 mg per kg, and I give that every 12 hours by mouth. And I'll do a 10 to 14 day course, repeating my urinalysis prior to finishing the course. And then I will repeat my urinalysis 1 week after the course finishes to make sure I've not got recurrence at that stage. And then we'll continue with ongoing monitoring. Now, in a lot of the books that you can get on exotic animal species, people will talk about flushing the bladder under general anaesthetic, using a fairly small, understandably, urinary catheter. Thorough prep cleaning of the area. Obviously, this needs to be done under general anaesthetic or deep sedation. Both males and females can be catheterized. The males are a little bit more finicky than the females, and we're using a 3 or maximum 5 French urinary catheter that's very well lubricated to do that. And the idea is that you're flushing and sort of trying to decontaminate the bladder, but it's not something that I will generally rush in to do, but it certainly is something that others report using, although we don't use it a lot at our clinic here. So medical treatments to think about, well, antibiotics, yes. Analgesia, as we've said, buprenorphine while in the hospital, meloxicam if we're comfortable that we've not got any hydration or renal issues. Bladder support, so it's one of these things where we'll often sort of borrow slash steal from other species using, off license and nutraceuticals, so something like Systese. There are obviously many other brands available, but just to provide ongoing bladder support, I know that some of the herbivore companies, Oxbow, for example, will make urinary sort of treat tablets as well that they can have one a day of. Fluid therapy is very important. We're wanting to try and flush that bladder through, and in a hospital setting, that can be intravenous, either with a little lateral saphenous catheter or cephalic is often more appropriate. And then oral fluids, and this is something that you can have the owners partake with at home, maybe giving them 1 mil syringe and just letting them do some slow 1 mil. Water feeds as well, making sure that they've got options of bottle and bowl, and if there's multiple animals, that there's a few different water points so that we've not got bullying or one sort of dominating over an area as well. And with bacterial infection, managing owner expectations. So when I see a cystitis case, I sort of let the owners know that it's a little bit like dental disease. This is something that we can hopefully get on top of. We can hopefully certainly improve quality of life, but they can be very frustrating, and we can see waxing and waning signs, and recurrence is very common. So we need to think about environmental management. Here you can see this was just a nice little setup of a number of guinea pigs that were in with us at one time, and my students made little hide boxes so that there was enough hides for each guinea pig. So we were reducing stress. We had numerous food sources. We had numerous water points. So again, we weren't having any competition for such things. Treating any underlying conditions, so again that we're not having immune compromise, and if passing urine is painful because we can't posture properly, for example, with stifle arthritis, then maybe considering long-term analgesia, and tramadol is something that I'll often reach to for my geriatric patients as well. And then when you look and do literature searches for cystitis, there is, as I said earlier, a lot of historic information available about laboratory animals from many years ago. And there's information available in books, but it's good to keep up to date with sort of new cases that have been reported. And this is an interesting one that was fairly recently in the veterinary record case reports, where it looked at four guinea pigs. And these were the frustrating cases that, they responded a little bit to treatment, but then we were having the relapses of the condition. And so the authors of this case, they thought it was a bit unique, and they've published to let others know that this is a potential problem that can be seen. So they had four guinea pigs. They cultured E. coli rather, as the most common bacteria. And although they tried treating with antibiotics and analgesia and bladder flushing, they were just having these recurring episodes. And an ultrasound exam showed that they had a sort of type of necrotizing cystitis, where the appearance was very thickened, irregular bladder wall. And this can be a reason why further investigation is important, particularly in cases where you're just not getting on top of things. And we'll discuss radiography and ultrasonography in a little minute, but quite an interesting case report for anyone wanting to read a little bit more about things. So we can't talk about cystitis without mentioning urolithiasis. Firstly, it is so common in guinea pigs, and as we've said, it can occur rather concurrently with urinary tract infections, and it's most commonly seen in middle-aged to older guinea pigs. And there are so many different conflicting reports that it's more common in females, no, it's more common in males, but actually it's just common. And depending on which reports you read, you may find it that in certain populations it's been reportedly more common in females, but ultimately the take-home message is males and females, it can occur with both. Now, we've said already that urine of guinea pigs is very alkaline. It has a high crystal content, and the calcium carbonate crystal is the most common. But we can also see calcium oxalate and calcium phosphate, and certainly struvite crystals as well. And the thing with all of those is that they are radio opaque, and that can make for a very useful when we are trying to diagnose these things with diagnostic imaging. So we can see the formation of stones, most commonly in the bladder or the urethra, but very much also reported and seen in the kidneys and the ureters. And of course, as you would expect with dog and cat as well, the clinical signs are very much dependent on both the size and the location of the urolith. So if you've got numerous small uroliths that are non-obstructive, then that's something that might cause a bit of discomfort, but ultimately these could pass on their own without any intervention. Whereas if you've got a large urolith, for example, in one ureter and it's obstructive, we then get a secondary hydronephrosis, which causes a lot of discomfort and the start of some dysfunction to that kidney. And that becomes a far more urgent situation. Now, hematuria is the most commonly associated abnormality of the urine associated with urolithiasis. And from the picture there, what we do find is that even if you've got a large quantity of sediment, that does not necessarily mean that you're going to have urolithiasis in the form of active stones present. So just because we've got a sample like that doesn't mean that there are stones throughout the urinary system. So how are we diagnosing these stones? Well, clinical signs certainly, but remembering that if we've got some bladder stones, then they may be fairly asymptomatic. Or if we've got a stone that's non-obstructive up in the kidney, then again we might not be seeing many signs associated with that. Or maybe we've just got something subtle like a little bit of weight loss. We can perform urinalysis to give us a heads up there's a problem with the presence of hematuria. But ultimately, we're wanting to take the next step to diagnostic imaging. And this is something that we would also look at doing with a bacterial cystitis to rule out that we don't have concurrent urolithiasis. So radiography or ultrasonography are our two sort of go-to ones. Now, we can also think about excretory intravenous pyelogram and obviously a CT scan as well. But those are often a bit of a leap. And to begin with, we start with our ultrasound or radiography. So for radiography, we've got the advantage that a lot of the uroliths are radio opaque. One of the most important lessons I think I've ever learnt is that it's always so important to include the very bottom of the guinea pig in your X-ray. Because even if you cut off at this point here, you can see that the distal urethra is a very common place to have a urolith. And if we don't take a complete radiograph, we could end up missing a stone, which is a bit awkward and embarrassing if that happens. Also, remembering two views as a minimum, so a TV and a lateral. And that's because we can get superimposition. We might overinterpret something within the GI tract, or we might not fully appreciate something if we've got food material in the GI tract or gas bubbles that are obstructing a little bit of our vantage point. Typically, I will perform radiography conscious in guinea pigs, and they seem to tolerate that well. So general anaesthetic is usually not needed unless you've got a very sort of hyper guinea pig and it's stressing them to be positioned. And again, just some examples, but we can have single dramatic sort of kidney stones where we can see we've got one here, or we can have this kind of situation where you can see all the little stones that have built up within this kidney. And this was one side at PM, and that was the other side in a little poor guinea pig. So for taking X-rays, often, particularly in geriatric animals, they will just sit for us. Sometimes what I'll do is put a very thin little towel just over this with no wrinkles to it, but just so they're not skidding about and feeling a bit vulnerable. If they prefer, then you can put a foam pad at the bottom just so they feel that they've got a sort of bumper stop to sit against. And we can also perform lateral. So this top one, sorry, it's a little fuzzy, but you can see that we've got just in a horizontal beam view. And that was because we had quite a severe cecal bloat, and we didn't want to put into lateral. But you can see that we've picked up on a little bit of calculi just within the urinary system there. But as I said, the majority of times I will do it conscious, and in that case, what I'm doing is I place a sandbag just gently over the shoulder area while they're in lateral, and usually they will just sit there for the 10 seconds it's going to take to take your view. You can gently extend the legs backwards, and that can then save the stress and potential risk associated with an anaesthetic, particularly in a sick patient. So for ultrasonography, we also need to have a big area of fur clip, put an ultrasound gel on, and definitely being mindful that then our patients could be prone to getting cold afterwards, particularly if they're unwell with that. But I do find ultrasound is very well tolerated, but I will ensure analgesia is on board, particularly if we're putting a probe against the bladder, and causing a bit of discomfort that way. For ultrasound, practice makes perfect. And the good thing with looking at kidneys is that there's two of them, so you can compare one to the other. Our normal values, we're looking about 2 centimeter length by about 1.4 centimeter width, and just slightly smaller height, slightly larger height wise, 1.5 centimeters. And we can look at the size, the shape. Have we got pelvic dilation? Is there the presence of any renalists with shadowing? And what we can say about a guinea pig renal pelvis is it is quite large and they do have a single longitudinal renal papilla. So here we've got an ultrasound of kidney. You can see the outline and the pelvis outlined as well. Versus this one, which obviously doesn't look very healthy, and there's quite a few cysts through that. So no shadowing to say that we've got stones, but certainly some renal cysts present. Ultrasound can be quite difficult for looking at ureters, particularly if you've got a bit of an old probe, an old machine rather. But you can see from this, let's get my arrow up, here we go. So this is a ureter. You can see how dilated this is, and you can see this stone structure sitting here, obstructing. The urinary bladder, so this is a very easy one to be ultrasounding because obviously you need it to be moderately full to see well, but you can see we've got this structure here. This was removed by cystotomy, and that's what we removed. So quite a large cystolith there. So how are we treating our urolithiasis? Well, it depends. If they're, as we said, small and non-obstructive stones, and we think that the animal can pass them, then we'll just give medical support, treat any concurrent bacterial infection, and continue to monitor. Whereas, if we are concerned that these are potentially going to obstruct, then obviously that is when we have to think about potentially intervention with surgery. Now, it's important to have a mention here about cystoscopy because that allows us to visualize the urinary bladder. It can potentially allow us to remove urethral calculi. Or to help sort of flush it back up into the bladder for removal at cystotomy. And potentially, if we put a little basket on it, then we can remove cystoliths and prevent or avoid any unnecessary surgical procedures. We can also use cystoscopy to perform bladder biopsies as well. So for our medical treatment part, similar to what we've discussed before, analgesia, bladder supplements, support, fluid therapy, and obviously antibiotics if warranted if there's bacteria present. But just to mention another interesting case report, and this is one just from this year, published in the Journal of Exotic Pet Medicine, looking at a 2-year-old female guinea pig with a distal urethral stone. All the normal clinical signs that we would expect, stranguria, dysuria, hematuria. And the authors had tried under GA to catheterize the urethra and flush, and they were unsuccessful with that using a 5 French catheter. They then performed cystoscopic guided transurethral laser lithotripsy under a general anaesthetic. So again, this is a good one to go and have a read of, but they basically broke up the stone and were able to have a minimally invasive approach for that, and then had good visualization of the urethra and bladder with no complications from it, and good resolution 6 months post procedure as well. So certainly we are taking more forward and advanced steps with guinea pigs, using modalities that we're seeing in other species as well. So when we're not going for a medical approach or we don't feel cystoscopy is a potential option to remove stones, then we can do cystotomy if the stone is in the bladder or if it's in the urethra, and we can flush it back up. And it's very similar to what we would do in a dog or cat, midline approach. Often there's a bit of fat associated with the bladder. This photo is of a rabbit bladder, but you can see the level of calcium sludge that's present there, and this was just at time of necropsy. What we have to be a little bit more mindful of in guinea pigs is our exposure of the abdomen, because they are so prone to cooling, and we can get hypothermia in our patients. And we've got to be very gentle with how we're handling the bowel to reduce the risk of adhesions and problems in recovery. With the bladder itself, we're placing our stay sutures. We aspirate the urine to prevent contamination when we incise into it. And we're removing the stones, always checking the trigone of the bladder to make sure there's not one hiding up in that area. And hopefully we've done our investigation with ultrasound or radiographs to know how many stones we're removing. And then we're just closing bladder with simple continuous inverting suture pattern. Just it's out with the remits of this talk, and I know we're running over slightly, but just to say urethrotomy we don't really recommend in this species. Tends to cause more problems than it solves. We get strictures or infection, some leaking of urine and hemorrhage, so not something that we'll typically go for. It's a very much last resort salvage sort of procedure. Whereas kidney and ureter calculi, the removal of stones is as described for other species, but what I would say is that if you are performing surgery on ureters, surgical loops can certainly make suturing of the ureter much, much easier. So other treatment of the medical to think about for urolithiasis, well, this is a repeat of the slide we've already had, because for bacterial cystitis, we have the similar kind of treatment again to consider for our urolithiasis. So antibiotics where appropriate, which they are in most cases, with confirmation of culture and sensitivity, provision of analgesia, bladder supplements, fluid therapy, and ensuring that the owner continues that at home. Other medical management to consider, so diet modification. So we want a low calcium diet. We don't want to add more calcium than we need to. So making sure that they have this high fiber, high hay diet, lots of timothy hay or meadow grass or oat hay. Really, we want to stay away from alfalfa hay, because it is so high in calcium. We have a low pellet diet, so provision of pellets, yes, but not in large amounts. Making sure that that pellet diet is a complete pellet, so i.e. not a muesli, and that we don't just feed, for example, kale every day. You know, we have a wide variety of vegetables, so we're not having concentration of a particular food type leading to, too high an intake. And then just on the side, because owners often ask this, well, you know, their dog is on a diet that is, you know, to prevent bladder stone formation, so why can't they have that for guinea pigs? And that is because we don't have an effective stone dissolution diet available. What we can say, however, is give guidelines on recommendations on foods to avoid. So we want to really avoid the foods with high levels of oxalates, or at least feed them in lower amounts. So that's spinach, it's kale, it's parsley, celery. Then making sure that we're not under or overdosing our vitamin C. So aiming about 50 milligrams per kilo per day, can go up to 100 mils per, milligrams per kilo per day, but certainly not wanting to aim for more than that. And then just last couple of slides, I thought it was important that I mention both potassium citrate and also hydrochlorothiazide as well. And this is because there is not a lot of science behind these two drug uses, but there is a lot of anecdotal information in some of the textbooks. So just to sort of mention them and discuss the theories behind them, but also the cautions as well with their use. So for potassium citrate, it is a calcium binder. So the idea of its use is that it's going to bind some of the urinary calcium. And it alkalizes rather the urine. Now, if we think about guinea pig urine, we already know it is alkaline. So therefore, further alkalination of it is probably not going to be that effective because it's not changing much of what's already there. But what we do know with potassium citrate is that hyperkalemia can occur with its ongoing use. So it's important that we are monitoring our plasma potassium levels to make sure that we don't get too high levels of those. The textbooks give 30 to 75 mg per kg by mouth twice daily as the kind of range of doses. And obviously, if you are going down the route of using that, then you've discussed the pros and cons with the owners. And you're getting off license consent use. And this is something that I think it's used more in the States than it does in the UK. But certainly it's not something that we've sort of gone in for using at our clinic just based on the sort of lack of scientific data behind it. Then we have the consideration of using a diuretic. Occasionally I have used this post cystotomy surgery for a sort of a few days. And the idea behind it is that we are reducing our urinary calcium, potassium, and citrate levels. However, if you are given a diuretic to an animal, then regardless of species, you should make sure that you're happy from a renal disease perspective and also that we've not got any fluid imbalances that we could worsen. And if the USG implies that your urine is already isosthenuric, then again, it's probably not going to be of any additional help. So, these are just things that are ones to consider. Certainly, some people will say, in my experience, this is what I use and it's effective, but it is an opinion rather than perhaps with a clinical study behind it. So, just to finish up, our prognosis for these cases, well, preparing the owners that recurrence is likely, and often management rather than total cure, or you could look on it that you cure the current flare-up and therefore successfully manage that, but the guinea pig is prone to having future relapses and future recurrences. And therefore, getting into this ideology of regular monitoring of urine samples. And for the dedicated owners, I also have some that will every 6 months book in for either a radiograph or an ultrasound just to make sure that if we've got ongoing management with urine samples and we get a positive hematuria, that we're not then having further urolithiasis formation as well. So definitely consider adding into your health checks of your geriatric guinea pigs your analysis as part of the procedure. So that's in a nutshell a little think about cystitis, and if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Jenna for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.